It. We're in Daniel chapter 2, and I'm again reading in verse 36, and from verse 36 I'm going to read down to verse 44. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold, and after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, forasmuch as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. And by being divided means it's divided in those two things, the iron and the clay. But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, forasmuch as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. But they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. Now notice verse 44, and in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, that's the millennial kingdom which we talked about, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Now, a few years ago, when I was in high school, very careful how to make this illustration, a few years ago when I was in high school, In West Virginia, you took driver's ed as a class in high school. It was a required class, which was really great because, I mean, it wasn't English, it wasn't math, it wasn't anything like that. It was, you either sat there and watched movies about people wrecking each other, or stories, horror stories about people, because they tried to, you know, scare you into being a good driver, or you went out in car and drove. So either way, it was a great thing. Either you watched a movie about scary stuff, or you went out and drove around for that entire class period. So when we had this driver's ed class, one of the things they taught us several statements. One was, what if? If you're going down the road, what if this car pulls up in front of you? What if this happens? What if you see that kid running down the sidewalk? What if he all of a sudden runs in front of you? What if? What if? What if? You know, always be thinking. And the other thing that they tried to drive into us was this: see the big picture. Do not wait until something happens right in front of you. You better be looking down the road, because what happens down the road eventually is going to impact you. If there's a car three car lengths ahead with its brake lights on, then you know the car in front of you is going to have to stop, and that means you're going to have to stop, so you got to see the big picture. So the idea is to respond what is happening ahead of you, way down the road from you. Don't wait until it comes to you. Now, it doesn't mean that whatever happens won't impact you. It just means you're ready for it. When we were on our trip to pick up the grandkids and went down there and coming back, same thing happened right around North Carolina, it seemed. Some reason it seemed right in that state. You're going down the road and you see these semis in the right lane. You're in the left lane because the semis are in the right lane. And you see down the road this semi deciding to pass other semis. So you see it coming over. It's 10, 12 car lengths down the road, and it comes over, and you know before you ever get there, you're going to have to slow down. And all the cars in front of you are going to have to slow down. And then you begin, sorry, Brother Choma, you begin thinking how much I hate truck drivers. Why are you in the left lane? Get back in the right lane. You're slowing everything down. But you know this, that is going to impact me, and that is going to have some bothersome conditions in my life, but I can be ready for it. Same thing is true when we think about end times. When we see the big picture, it doesn't change what's happening. And it doesn't mean what's happening isn't going to impact us or bother us. What it means is this, that I understand what's happening, I'm prepared to respond to what's happening in a biblical way. And so when we come to Daniel chapter 2, the Lord now gives us a big picture concerning the end times. He doesn't go into a lot of details. There's other places that have more details. But in this, is just like the big picture. He basically says to Daniel, here's what's happening from here to the end. I'm showing you the big picture so that people can be prepared. It doesn't mean it won't impact us. Doesn't mean it won't bother us, but it does mean that we can be prepared and thus respond biblically to what is happening. So what is the Lord telling us about this big picture so that we can know about it and then respond in a proper way? Well, there's three things I'm going to share with you tonight and then add about three or four more things the next lesson to help us understand this. So go back with me to chapter 2. Look with me in verse 31. It says, "Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands." Again, that's representing the millennial kingdom. "Which smote the image upon his feet," the iron and the clay there, "which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces." And thus the whole statue, the whole image was destroyed. And so here's the first thing we understand. Number one is this. There will only be 5 one-world kingdoms prior to the millennial kingdom. Now that may, for some of you, that's old hat, but it's important that we understand this. He's not talking about 5 of the world kingdoms. He's saying there's only 5 world kingdoms. This is not 5 of 10. This is 5 of 5. So he's telling us in the entire history from Daniel going forward, there would only be 5 kingdoms that would have control of the known world of its time. Starting with the head of gold, which was Babylon, ending with those feet of iron and clay, which is the kingdom of the Antichrist. Don't get ahead of me, Douglas Vogel. Now, let me give you a graphic that kind of illustrates this. Now, I'm not exactly sure how exactly it looked because Daniel, for some reason, didn't take a picture of it. But this is our understanding. At least this is some way to look at it. And so you have this big statue, and it starts with the head of gold. It goes to silver, to brass, to iron and clay. And each one represents a world kingdom. And it'll say right there on the side, you see, that starts with Babylon, down to the Persians, Medes and Persians, Greece, ancient Rome, and then this, which would be the Antichrist kingdom. And the rock over here, representing stone cut out without hands, representing the millennial kingdom, which comes, hits it on the feet. In other words, the last kingdom is destroyed, and thus the whole statue, which has some significance as well. So watch this. 4 of these kingdoms have already occurred. Babylon, Persia, Greece, and the Romans. Almost said the Roman Catholics. And the Romans. 4 of these kingdoms have already occurred. Now let's do some quick math. Okay? There's going to be 5. 4 has occurred. How many is left? 1. Okay? That means there's only 1 more to come, the one world kingdom of the Antichrist. They say, well, duh, okay, but think about that. Anyone who's threatening to set up a world kingdom, let's say like Adolf Hitler, if he is not the Antichrist, will he succeed? No, he will not. No one can set up a one world kingdom other than the Antichrist. He's the last in this chain of one world kingdoms. So whoever is the Antichrist will be and sets up that one world kingdom. That is it. There is no other one world kingdoms between now where we're at today, July the 14th, 2021, until the very day the Antichrist sets up his kingdom, there will be 0 one world kingdoms. The next one world kingdom is the kingdom of the Antichrist. Okay, there's only 5. 4 have happened. That means there's only 1 to be left. Now, this kingdom of the Antichrist, let me just give this to you and then move on, because number 2 is where I want to spend a little bit more time. But this kingdom we're talking about, this last one world kingdom, the kingdom of the Antichrist, will be satanic in origin. And by that, I mean it's Satan's last hurrah. He's moving, he's inspiring, he is working these things to accomplish what he's trying to accomplish. And therefore, it's going to be ungodly in his practice, in his behavior, in what he's trying to do. Let's look at some verses about this before we move on. Revelation 13, if you will. Revelation 13. And then we'll come back and look at some things about this statute as we consider now what this last kingdom. Revelation 13, look at verse 1. We're going to read a lengthy passage. But I want you to notice the origin and the practice, the satanic origin, the ungodly practice that's being talked about here. Revelation 13, verse 1, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon," that would be Satan, gave him his power and his seat and great authority." That's what he said, satanic in origin. "And I saw one of his heads as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world wondered after the beast," this supernatural healing then draws people to him. "And they worshiped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast who is able to make war with him?" I think the idea is by worshiping the beast, they're worshiping the dragon. "And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And power was given to him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him." Now we'll go into more detail, a little bit more detail next lesson. "Whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints." In other words, the Lord's in charge. He knows what he's doing. Everything's okay. "And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. And he had 2 horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast. This is what we typically call the false prophet, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And they deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast." Now, where did he get his power from? The dragon, Satan. Let me just stop and say this. People ask me sometimes, well, how do you answer these people who seem to do, these miracles? Power only comes from one of two places, either God or Satan. And if what you're doing is not of God, there's only one other source. And these people who seemingly can do things that are supernatural, but yet they have an ungodly life, their power is not coming from God. Let me continue on. "That they should make an image," verse 14, "and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. And his number is 666, 666, very famous number there. Now, there's more I want to say, but I don't want to take away from next week's lesson. But I'll just say this, this whole kingdom, this is the final one world kingdom. It's satanic in origin, ungodly in practice, and that is the kingdom of the Antichrist. Number two, let's spend a little bit more time on the second one. Each kingdom arises from the previous kingdom. Now, this is an important concept to understand. And I'm going to go back to the statute to help you understand that. This is connected together. This is the way Daniel saw it. He saw an image of a man, and this is how he described it, and that's how an artist's rendition of it. But notice everything is connected. Everything flows from the top to the bottom. They're all interconnected. This isn't simply five separate kingdoms with no connection. Whatever began in Babylon, now listen to this statement, whatever began in Babylon is completed with the Antichrist. This is the plan of Satan from beginning to end. He's always trying to work against the things of God. Eventually, Christ comes and destroys the entire work, and it all crumbles down. The idea that the feet there, it means that's the end, but also it means this. This is what everything's resting upon, his final thrust Satan is giving. And when he destroys the feet, everything is destroyed. The complete work of Satan is destroyed there. So each kingdom arises from this previous kingdom, which means this. The ingredients of one kingdom are found in the kingdom that came before it. Now, we won't go into all the history of it, but if you study Babylon, you know that it was the Babylon that really began. The Persians kind of overran them, but Babylon became the breeding ground of much of what then the Persians. There was some connection in the past. They were kind of hobnobbing together, and then they kind of pushed the Persians out, and the Persians came and said, no, we'll take over. And so the Babylons became kind of the breeding ground for the Persians. And then when the Persians rose up, and then Alexander came and overthrew the last of the Persian, whatever they were called, the kings, but there's a special name for them. And then they took them over, and then now Alexander took over the Persian Empire and began adopting Persian beliefs and mannerisms, which created some problem with the Greeks. And then from that, you had the Romans who overtook the Greeks, who adopted a Greek culture into themselves. And to the end, which, interesting enough, the iron of the Roman Empire is seen again in the feet of iron and clay. So whatever is going on in the Roman Empire flows into this final kingdom. So what does that mean? Well, there's a couple of thoughts that we think about this. So let me just give you a couple. It seems that the Antichrist kingdom will be some type of a revised Roman Empire. Some say restored Roman Empire. Now, let me just stop for a moment. Interesting enough, we're not going to go down this trail, but it's something to think about. In the book of Revelations, you'll find Babylon mentioned. But mentioned almost, not literally as they're talking about the kingdom of Babylon, but used as by application to what's going on in the end times there. And so Babylon is kind of describes all that Satan is doing. In other words, Babylon's the head, the mindset, the thinking behind it. And also interesting enough, you know where Babylon is built on? Babel, land of Shinar. And so it all kind of, you'll see this one world kingdom all throughout Satan trying to do. So it seems like now the Antichrist kingdom will be some type of revised Roman Empire because that iron is still going on into the feet. Now, what does that mean? Well, Doug mentioned something, and I will now build upon it. It may mean, and I say may because it hasn't happened, and prophecy always has a question mark because it's future. It may mean that this one world Antichrist kingdom is Europe-centric in area. What did you call it? European Union. Okay, Europe-centric in area because Roman Empire was Europe-centric. So it means that we think the Antichrist Empire will be built on the land of Europe and then stretching out. Maybe the U.S. somehow becomes subservient to Europe. It may mean, some think, may mean that its leader, this Antichrist, is European. It most likely means that the policy of the Antichrist kingdom is the same policy of the Roman Empire. Anyone know what the policy of the Roman Empire is? It's called Pax Romana or Pax Romana, which means it's called Roman peace. Rome loved peace. Their policy of peace was this. Either we come to you and you do what we want and there's no trouble,
or we come to you and you don't do what, we kill you, and then there's no trouble. There was no let's get together, come to a conclusion. It was, we're coming in, here's what we're going to do, and don't cause problems, because when you cause problems, we don't like it, and we kill you. That's what happened in the Middle East. That's why when Jesus was brought before Pontius Pilate, and Pontius Pilate, remember, what did his wife come and say? Have no doings with this man. I've been troubled in dreams. I'm a little paraphrase, troubled in dreams by him. And Pilate was wanting to get rid of him. And remember what the Jewish leader said? They said to Pontius Pilate, if you don't do this, then you're not a friend to Caesar. Basically what they're saying is, and you can go into history, but Pontius Pilate always had trouble with the Jewish people. Everyone had trouble with Jewish people because the Jewish people didn't like the Romans. And basically what they would do is, we'll go to Caesar and we'll complain, or we'll riot, we'll cause these trouble. And when the Caesar found out there was trouble, then he was always like, what is going on? We want peace. And so he'd have to kill a bunch of the Jewish people and usually kill some of his leaders who weren't doing what they should have been doing. And so he had what was called Pax Romana. So our understanding is this, that the rule, the policy of this world domination of the Antichrist will be just like Rome, which was, you will do what we want because that's how we're going to have peace. Let me show you a verse and then I'll explain what that means a little bit more. Go back with me to Daniel. Because you may say, well, what does this have to do with anything? Well, let me explain, and I think you'll understand, because we kind of see this happening right now. Daniel chapter 8. Look with me in verse 23. Daniel 8, verse 23. And in the latter time of their kingdoms, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding, dark sentences shall stand up. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper and practice and destroy the mighty and the holy people. Now think of all that I just said. What does it imply that he's doing? Destroying, killing people, right? This is not someone who's like, what can I do to get along with you? He's coming to you saying, you will do what I say or you will die. And through his policy also, he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand and shall magnify himself in his heart. Now watch the next statement. And by peace shall destroy many. In other words, that's his excuse. His excuse is, we're trying to have peace here. We don't like what you're doing. We're going to kill you because we're trying to have peace. Well, that kind of goes against having peace, but that's their thinking. And by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And it goes back to the millennial kingdom. So here's the understanding. To understand this view of peace, we have to understand the same view of toleration. What is the view of toleration? Well, as you agree with them, as long as you agree with me, then I tolerate you. If you don't agree with me, I don't tolerate you. Is that really toleration? That's not really toleration, is it? But that's how the world looks at it. You can be anything you want to be as long as it's what they want you to be. You can say anything you want on social media as long as it agrees with what social media says. You can broadcast whatever you want on YouTube as long as it agrees with what YouTube wants broadcast. But if it doesn't go against what they want, that's not toleration. That's more like censorship. And so the world's view of toleration is we only tolerate those who agree with us. That's the same view they have of peace. As long as you go along with them, there's peace. As long as you agree to what they're doing, as long as you don't go against, if you agree with abortion, the world loves you. If you agree with all of their one world thinking, if you agree with don't take religion seriously, as long as you agree with what the world is thinking, the world's fine. You're at peace with the world. You know when that peace ends? When you stand for Christ. Because that is the whole idea of the world. And that's what is going to be personified in the Antichrist kingdom. When all of a sudden, when we as believe, not we, they, I'm going to be raptured out of here. I don't know about you, I'm getting raptured out of here, I'm born again. And so who's ever saved during this tribulation period, who's ever on this earth that the Antichrist is coming after, they would have peace with the Antichrist. As long as they get the mark and go along and worship the image and do what he wants, there's going to be peace. You know when the peace is gone? when they refuse to go along with the Antichrist. Now, I'm not trying to say, okay, I'm not trying to have insurrection against the government. But I'm going to say this. You can see that happening today, can't you? Our government's happy with us as long as we agree with the government. But when all of a sudden we don't dance to their tune, when they're playing, you know, when the Pied Piper's playing their music and we won't all line up and follow them, all of a sudden now we're the radicals, we're the problem. No, I just don't believe like they believe. And in a free country, okay, this is radical speech right now. In a free country, that's promoted and understood. But not so much when there's no free country. Then how come you don't believe like us? Because I believe like the Bible. That's why. And so you'll see that all throughout all of these kingdoms, this idea of their idea of peace and toleration was always going with them. Remember the three Hebrew children? We're all at peace as long as everyone bows down to the same statue. But when you don't bow down, there's no peace for you. And so that is the view of this whole statue, and it's personified when you get to the feet there in the Antichrist. Let me point out one more thing about this. The one area that each kingdom had in common was the Middle East, and thus Israel. All of these one world kingdoms have this one thing in common, this Middle East area, especially the land of Israel. Let me show you what I mean by that. If you look at the Babylonian Empire, here's the Middle East. They don't go too much that way. They don't go too much this way. Okay, this is another kingdom. Okay, I don't want to confuse you. They don't go too much this way or into Europe, but they do have the Middle East. Well, then when the Persians take over, they do go this way, which would be east. They do go east, but they don't go too far west. They don't go into Europe, but they still have the Middle East. And then when the Greeks take over, you know, they have a huge area. They have, Greece, which is the bottom of Europe, into all the way over to Persia down here and the Middle East. And then you go to Rome. Rome kind of loses a lot of the eastern part of the empire that Greece had. But they have a whole lot more of the Western Empire, and they still have the Middle East. So each of these are slightly different, but each of these have that same area of the Middle East. And the same true when you think about the kingdom of the Antichrist, and we briefly talked about him, I think we did, or maybe it's in a future lesson. Sometimes I get them confused which one I've taught and which I'm going to have him, but... Well, he will also be dealing with Israel. I do think it's in a future lesson. So this will be the same area that's part of the Antichrist kingdom. One more statement about it, and that is this: world history and prophecy. Now, just think about this for a moment. 6,000 years of world history. World history and prophecy revolves geographically around the land of Israel. That in itself is impossible unless there's something else behind it. That's not true about America. We're relatively new on the world stage. It's not true about Europe. It's not true about China. It is true about that spot right there in the Middle East, which if you go there, I mean, other than Israel, it's before there was oil. I mean, really, what did you have? You had sand and you had sun. You didn't really have much at all. But yet, world history and prophecy revolves, and I believe the reason is because that's the land that was promised to the Jews. This is a prophetic thing that God is doing, and Satan is opposed to the things of God. And he's always fighting against it. So each of these kingdoms arises from the previous kingdoms. The same policy continues on, the same thought process, the same thrust, all the way from Babylon to the end, which is the Antichrist. And then the last statement I'll give you before I give you something else. Number three is this. Each kingdom is of lesser value than the previous kingdom. It's a downhill direction. Man does not improve. Man goes down, especially as we get away from the Lord. If you go back and look at that statue again, You start with gold, you end up with clay, iron and clay. The value continues to decrease. The forward progress of this world is also a downward progress from the Lord. The more the world progresses to what they're trying to do, the more it gets away from the Lord. And you'll see that from that statue. You go from gold all the way down to clay. The more it's trying to do what it's trying to do, the more it gets away from the Lord, and the lesser value as far as not how the Lord values them, but what they're able to do, they're really who they are as people. And I alluded to this, I'll give this to you here. Just like in the Tower of Babel, the world comes together in rebellion to the Lord. The reason the Lord joins forces is not for the betterment of man. That's what they say. Let's all come together and we can be better. But yet they all come together because they're trying to reject the Lord. Let me just say this. If you are what you should be as a Christian, and now listen carefully how I say this, because I'm not saying live to yourself and ignore people. But I'm saying in a spiritual sense, if you are what you are, should be in Christ, you don't need other people. Your security is in Christ. You don't need to have a bunch of friends. You don't need to have everyone else to agree with you. You don't have to go on Facebook and just wait and make a post and just, I hope I get a bunch of likes. Oh, good, they're liking my post. I can make it through another day. Okay, that's not how mature believers live. Our security is not in the crowd. Our security is in the Lord. That's not how the world is. For the world, it must have the crowd. The world must have the majority. The world must get everyone on its side, either by coercion or by force. You must be on our side, because that's how the world is. It finds its strength in its numbers. That's not how believers are. We find our strength in our Savior. But yet, the world is opposite of that. Each of these one world kingdoms, in many ways, is a renewed effort to establish a successful Tower of Babel. Hold your place in Daniel. Go with me to Genesis 11. Look with me in verse 1. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar. That's where Babylon is going to be located. And they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick and burn them throughly. And they had brick for stone and slime had they for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach into heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will restrain from them which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. That ended that episode. But each one of these one world kingdoms is simply a renewed effort to do exactly what they're doing here. To combine everyone together, have their one religion that kind of worships man, and it's all self-focused on themselves. Go with me to Romans 1. Now, I'm purposely leaving some things unsaid because I want to go back next week and build on it. But really what I want you to just see is this is the five world kingdoms. This is the thrust of the world. It's always been this way. We don't need to say, what's happening? What's happening in the world? Let me tell you what's happening in the world. The same thing that's always been happening in the world. There's a thrust by man to establish his kingdom to do what he wants to do apart from God. You see that from the head to the feet. That's all what's going on. And the more they do it, the more they get away from God, the worse the world gets. How do I know that? Romans 1, verse 21. Because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man, and to birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into a lie, and worship and serve the creature more than Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. It's a downward slide here. For this cause God gave them up unto vile affections, for even their women, to change the natural use into that which is against nature, and likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in her lust, one toward another, men with men, that's homosexuality, that's a sin. Men with men working that which is unseemly, and receiving themselves that recompense of their error, which was meat. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to reprobate mind, to do those things which are not convenient, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetous, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful, who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. You know, you go back to the head, which is Babylon, when Daniel interacted with King Nebuchadnezzar, there was a respect towards the Lord. There's some debate whether Nebuchadnezzar got saved or not. It's neither here nor there. Scholars make some debate about that. But here's what is true. He did have some recognition of the Lord, some respect for the Lord, some of the things He says. So here's the head. He gets confronted with the truth, and he says, hey, there's at least by minimum, there's a God in heaven. He's right. When you get to the feet, to the Antichrist and to the final one world kingdom, there is no respect of God. There is no thought of God. It's all about him. He's hateful. He's killing people. Even the mention of God sets them in a rage. What I'm saying is, from the beginning to the end, it's a downward slide this world is going. Our hope cannot be in this world. Now, if we think that somehow we're going to fix this world and it's all going to be some type of paradise, then you are misunderstanding what's happening. From the very beginning to the very end, it's a downward slide. The only thing that's going to fix this world is the Lord Himself. Now, personally, I'll do anything I can to help people along the way. And maybe you know, if the end is not for a long period of time from now, then, yeah, we want to kind of slow it down if we can. We want to try to help people along the way. But we're not going to stop it. Because the purpose and the plan of God is already decided. Vote. You ought to vote. You ought to know the things. You ought to vote. You ought to make your voice heard. You ought to love people. You ought to be a good citizen. All those things are positive and right. But we're not going to fix the world. The world's on a downhill slope. The only hope of this world is Jesus Christ. And thank God He's coming again. And He's going to make all the wrongs right. And that's the hope of this world. Every bit of this statute is wrong, it's self-centered, it's man-centered, and it's going the wrong direction. Let me give you a couple just final thoughts about this. Go back with me to Daniel 2. If you held your place, you'll be flipped there real fast. If you're like me or didn't, then I'll just talk for a few moments while I flip through my Bible trying to look inconspicuous as I try to find Daniel 2 again real fast. Daniel chapter 2, look with me in verse 34. Let's kind of tie it all together tonight. Tie it up and be done with this lesson for this night. Verse 34. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet. This is the Lord. This is him setting up his kingdom. That were of iron and clay and break them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, now watch this, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together. All at once God destroys the work of man. And became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. All gone. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Now watch this statement. The big picture of the end times is the glorification of Christ, not the comfort of man. believers are to find their peace in what brings glory to God, not in what makes our lives more comfortable. If we're in a downhill slide, and the only thing that's going to fix it is the Lord Himself. But between now and when the Lord fixes it, we have whatever's going to happen, and then we have the tribulation period, and then the Lord comes. And so it's not about our comfort. It's about the Lord's glory. Maybe the biggest void in our discipleship as believers, the biggest missing part of our discipleship, is this understanding that we're here for Him. And that means our comfort does not come before His glory. We ought to be willing to suffer, if necessary, for the cause of Christ to succeed. Say, well, Pastor White, I just want to live in a country where it's free and I can get everything I want and do everything I want and never have any problems. Me too. It's not going to happen. Our best hope is revival, and revival is only going to slow down things. It's not going to fix it. We're headed to the Antichrist. It's a part of God's plan. We are called to be His disciples, to be the light and the salt and the light of this earth. And much of that is going to require us to bear our cross and suffer for the name of Christ. And it should be our privilege to do so. God does not gently and nicely overcome these kingdoms. He doesn't come to the statue and go, please, please, could I just take over for a while? Okay, thank you. He doesn't do that. He comes and smashes them. It's an act of destruction. He comes in fury. He comes in wrath. He destroys these works that are set up against them. So it's a sudden, a complete destruction upon the statue. And that is what brings about the millennial kingdom. And that's where we find our comfort and peace. So until the Lord comes and does His work, we are here in many ways like Christ, His suffering servants. God has called us to suffer for the cause of Christ. Doesn't mean we can't have family and friends and have joy and have peace, but it means that this world is not our home. We're looking for a place to come. Believers who understand what God is trying to accomplish should seek prophetic fulfillment rather than worldly safety. Let me give you an example of what I mean by it. Go with me to Revelation 22. It's the last verse we'll look at tonight. Revelation 22. The Apostle John has just been given the revelation of Jesus Christ. He just has seen unbelievable things. And part of what he's seen is very horrific. Our understanding of the tribulation period, we have at least 50% maybe population decrease on the earth. They're stacking up, and I don't say this in an unkind, unfeeling way, but basically they're stacking up people like you'd stack up wood getting ready for the winter fire. They're just stacked up on each other. There's just unbelievable amount of dead people just everywhere. There's wars, there's famine, there's plagues. John has just seen all of these things. It's horrific. It's gut-wrenching. He's like, oh, you can imagine, he's like, oh, I can't believe all that's going to happen. The wrath of God poured out on this earth for this tribulation period. How terrible it's going to be. I wonder how he responds to this. Does he say, oh, no, Lord, don't do that. Oh, no, I don't ever want that to happen. That's not how he responds. Look at verse 16 of Revelation 22. Thank you. I, Jesus, have sent mine angel to testify unto you these things in the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David and the bright and morning star. And the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let him that hears say, come. And let him that is athirst come. And whosoever will, let him take the water of life freely. For I testify unto every man that heareth the words of the prophecy of this book. If any man shall add unto these things, God shall add unto him the plagues that are written in this book. And if any man shall take away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God shall take away his part out of the book of life, and out of the holy city, and from the things which are written in this book. He which testifies these things saith, Now, this is the Lord speaking. Surely I come quickly. That means I'm about to do this. These horrific judgments are about to come on the earth. Here's what John says. Even so, come, Lord Jesus. It may affect me, it may affect my loved ones, it may affect my family, it may affect people who I care deeply about, but you're more important. Even so, come, Lord Jesus. These horrors could involve even John's own loved ones, but he thought the glory of God more important than his own comfort. So I give you the last statement tonight. World-shaking events should bring about a fervent faithfulness rather than a fearful fleeing. It may be things that we don't want to happen, but they have to happen. And therefore, we trust the Lord in these things. And we're faithful to the Lord, fervently faithful, even in these difficult things. All right, let's